welcome to The Mariner with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And this is another one of these dog watches. It's a shorter show. It gives me the opportunity just to throw a few things together, not have to have too much of a plan. I do sometimes have a plan, despite the way it sounds on your end. We've got two things we're going to do today, both of which are kind of easy for me to do and involve nothing more than having to sit here and look at the computer. But both, I think, have got the potential to be interesting. So one is responding to YouTube comments, which is like a new sport, although I am very aware of the very learned advice from podcasters like people like Joe Rogan not to read the comments. At the moment, the comments are all very positive and wonderful, although I see a couple of dissenting voices here. What the hell is this? Anyway, the other thing we're going to do is I've floated the idea of talking about sailboats as bug out vehicles, and that tickled a particular group of people. The prepping thing is kind of interesting. I live in quite a rural situation here in Nova Scotia, and I have lived in some very rural situations around the world. So being quite independent is something that's close to my heart anyway, and it's all exactly the same as on a boat. So I thought, you know, we can include a couple of different audiences here and recognize that we all have the same kind of interest area and we all have the same skill set. If you can keep a boat going at sea with a little family on board for like a week, that's great. That's a level of bug out vehicle many people dream of. So I thought what we'll do is we'll get ChatGPT to lead us through a conversation about how sailboats can be used to escape a zombie apocalypse. I'm not unaware of the irony of asking AI to give me some information on this, but I figure, you know, hey, whilst it's still dumb, let's get all the information we can from it. And then later, maybe we can find some nooks and crannies to hide in whilst it roams the earth. So without any further ado, let's have a quick look at the first of the YouTube comments. Great job. Thanks. That was an easy one. I just put a little thumbs up. Great. Learned and informative. Wow, that's awesome. The person's handle is E12_Sterling, and they're a member on YouTube. Awesome. But they are using it as learned and informative. Not I learned, but learned and informative. This person is a scholar. He says, I had a few close calls with winch handles. This requires consideration. Well, this is a very thoughtful person. I think it's like an Oxford Don has decided to frequent the channel here. This requires consideration. Okay, cool. You get a thumbs up as well. Okay, next person here is Mr. Silver Dragon Light. And he says, you mentioned Super B talking about colors of the rope. Were you referring to Super Bijou, later renamed Medallia for the 2020 Vendée Globe? Okay, all right. No, I ended up calling my Open 60 Bella originally. And then over time that evolved into Super B. You know, you're on this thing for just days and days and days and days. You end up talking to it. So it has nicknames. And so it then Super B is also a model of performance package that you can get on like Dodge Chargers and Challengers. And I live in North America. I'm aware of it. So I think that's just how it became colloquial for me. But yeah, Super Bijou, was that not Bernard Stamm's boat? That was Chemin Pujolet, right? And he put it on the Kerguelen Rocks or something. I'll have to remember that story, but no, there's no similarity between the two. But I can see people are pretty sharp. If you can pick that detail up from just that little comment, I'm going to have to make sure, I'm going to have to go through everything I say with a fine tooth comb and probably remove everything. Okay, next person is Wave 6413. He says, he's responding to a video of me swimming off the back of the trimaran in the Atlantic. Well, I guess in the Sargasso Sea, technically, between the Windward Isles and Bermuda. That was the trip I was on the trimaran Spirit. You can see all of that story over on YouTube. And he says, how many single-handers are recovered from the waters in the Bahamas and elsewhere in that part of the world with their fly down? You had very good precautions for swimming, but it always feels like Russian roulette. Body, meat, bucket of seawater. Absolutely correct. And I clipped myself on like with two separate ropes and had one to hold on to and was very, very aware of it. But I got to say, like, there was no wind at all. Definitely Portuguese man of war could have been a problem in that part of the world, but it was all good. That's the second time I've been off a boat ever, and it was in the same patch of water. And that's kind of why I thought I knew to trust it a little bit. I've spent a lot of time lounging around in blank patches halfway between the Caribbean and Bermuda. So I'm pretty aware that you've got a couple of hours. And it's nice temperature water and everything else, but I got to say, I was very nervous doing that video. I wanted to do it to talk a little bit about, you know, what it might be like going off the back of a boat and to simulate somewhat what might that feel like to try and, I know, shock people a little bit into considering clipping on all the time. But just doing it was petrifying because obviously it's hundreds of miles to anywhere. He continues, there is video evidence of a very, very, very experienced parachute videographer who jumped out of a plane with a backpack on. The backpack was camera gear and not a parachute, as he assumed it to be. Oh no. The film of him muttering about not having a parachute survived the drop, but he didn't. Oh no. I'm going to put a thumbs up on that. Wow, thank you for writing all that, Wave 6413. This is, I wonder as the cameraman if he was aware that the GoPro was still running. Oh, that's so awful, isn't it? Look, I guess the fact that he writes there very, very, very experienced, that's both a badge of honor and it's just playing chicken with statistics. Every time I have to say the word statistics when I'm reading these books for the Mariner's Library, I always stick on it. You know, it's so easy to become a statistic when you are involved in something all the time and literally experience all parts of the bell curve. In the end, you're going to be on the bit where disaster strikes. I guess I've just got that in my mind at the moment because I've been doing these podcasts about the life raft and everything where everything is doom and disaster. But yeah, you know, you just get so comfy with it. You just do it. And then one day it's not the right thing. Can you imagine? Okay, let's go on. Let's find something more cheery. Hey, it's... Oh, yeah. So I've actually responded to... Hey, I've actually got the book here to respond to this. I knew this question was in here somewhere. It's him again. Wave 6413. I'm going to write to you and tell you that your answer is on this podcast. He says, rope. Only one rope on a sailing vessel, the bell rope. And I'd already responded to him in YouTube, but I guess I knew it'd be on this list somewhere. I have got a book here. It's even relatively close by. Hang on. Jesus. Oh, here we go. It's under the cereal bowl. I'm so middle-aged now that my evening treat to myself is a bowl of cereal with no sugar on, and it's Cheerios because they don't have folic acid and there's no or very little sugar, I think, in those. How bloody I have like swallowed the anchor. All right. So, Mr. Wave 6413, damn your black heart, sir. I've got a book in front of me here and we're going to have a little chit chat about ropes on boats. Oh, well, there might not be that many. It's only half an hour. There might not be that many YouTube comments. We'll still do the AI thing though. That'd be fun. Okay. So this book, which was written by someone called L. Francis Hereshoff. I'm not sure if you've heard of that name before. Hereshoff. He says, ropes. How many ropes are there on a ship? This old catch question is usually answered by saying 6 or 9, as all the rest of the cordage has proper names that can be classed in the categories of halyards, sheets, braces, buntlines, clews, shrouds, stays, downhauls, cables, warps, lines, pennants, and pendants. But a closer look at the matter reveals that there are about 40 properly named ropes on some good-sized sailing vessels of the past. It must be remembered that the cordage used in most tackles was called rope, for instance, gun training tackle rope, and even today we use the name backstay runner tackle rope. Okay, so L. Francis Hereshoff, whoever the hell that person is thinking that perhaps this might not be true. So I'm not going to go into this for too long because there's quite a lot of them, but we'll go through it quickly and let's see if any of them apply to modern boats. Awning rope, a rope around an area to which an awning is laced. Yep, we have those. Back rope, the rope pendant or small chain for staying the dolphin striker. Well, if you have a dolphin striker, you have a back rope. Bell rope, yes, we know that one. Boat's rope, a separate rope veered to the boat to be towed at the ship's stern. Oh, so if you're putting out a tow rope, oh, it's not called a tow rope, it's called a boat rope. Bolt rope, a hard-laid rope used in several places where it is not required to flex, such as the head rope, foot rope, leech rope, and luff rope of a sail. Breast rope, a rope fastened along the lanyards of the shrouds to secure the leadsman when in the chains heaving the lead. Okay, you get that one off. But a lot of the others, it goes on and on. Breech rope, bucket rope, bull rope, boy rope, cat rope, check rope, clue rope, davit rope. It's not looking good. Entering ropes that you put on either side of the gate through the lifelines to help people when they're entering the boat. Foot ropes, a rope suspended under a yard or boom for men to stand on. Grab rope, a line secured above a boat boom or gangplank for steadying oneself. Hawse rope, a rope used to take the strain off the anchor warp when clearing hawse. Jaw rope, a rope over the jaw of a gaff to keep it from leaving the mast. So what I'm starting to see here is that, firstly, there are lots of ropes that are still on boats. And if you have a traditional boat, then you have loads of things called ropes on board. Probably not the full 40 here, but I'd say you've probably got about 30. You know, slip rope here, a rope whose bite is passed through the ring of a mooring buoy with both ends on shipboard, otherwise known as lunch loop. By letting go one end and hauling on the other, the ship is freed. So it's almost as though yachties don't know the words for anything, so they just decided that nothing's called rope because they didn't know which one was which. So they just call it XYZ plus the word line, and then there is nothing is called a rope. So I put it to you, and I've got this guy here, L. Francis Hereshoff, says it as well. There's lots of things on a boat other than the bell rope that have the moniker rope, but obviously you'd need to know them to be able to have a conversation. So a little sarcastic perhaps, but that's how I'm feeling. I hear that all the time. It's like, well, I started out on square riggers and I was in the Navy. I've heard a lot of things called rope. So I don't know. We'll have a see. He says, I've been watching that. Okay, so that's looking at that. Dude, oh, ho, ho, yes, here we go. Dissenting voices. Damn your black hearts. Quick, Justin, get rid of these people. Dude, he says, that is so not a code zero. Okay, cool. Code zero measures as a spinnaker. Nearly. Which means mid-girth is, oh, capitals, at least 75% of the foot length. Absolutely right. In IRC racing, currently there is a new definition of an oversized jib called a tweener. I did not know that. Intended for boats that have non-overlapping jibs rather than genoas. There is a rating penalty associated with this sail that a code zero doesn't incur because it's actually technically a spinnaker. What you are flying in this video may have started life as a code zero and was cut down, perhaps why the back part of the graphic is absent, but it is effectively now a jib top, very fair point, which has a high clue, so it is a relatively relatively insensitive to lead position when cracked off a bit. Good close reaching sail. Well, hey, I agree with most of that, but number one, the reason that the clue is so high is because that is an open 60 sail and I'm sailing it on an 80 foot maxi. So all correct, apart from no, it's just a wrong sail on that boat. When it's working as a, when the exact same sail is slightly close to the deck on another boat, it's definitely a code zero. And this other thing here, so he says it's not a code zero. Code zero measures as a spinnaker. Well, in the end it did, but obviously at the beginning it didn't. When it was first made, it was actually as a jib. And I know that because when we had Amersport 1, which was a Volvo 60, which had an original cut code zero on it, we measured at like 1404, I think, for IRC. And if we took that one sail off, we measured like 1380, something like that. I knew that that was the place to look because I worked with a guy called Joachim Visser in the UK in about 2010, a guy called the Speed Doctor, who's like an IRC technician. And we had this opportunity with a particular boat to put in a lot of different certificates in a short period of time with IRC. And they just brought in the T-keel rule, which had added 2 points. Everyone get paying an extra couple of points, and it made a mess up of a regatta we were doing and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, we had to get this boat down a couple of rating points. So IRC was still relatively unknown, the technicalities of the rule. It's still a secret rule, but people have a pretty fair idea now what works and what doesn't. But at that time, it was new. So basically, the idea was either the boat needed to be shorter, it needed to be heavier, or it needed to have smaller head sails. And we weren't sure which metric we were able to really get a move on. So we We got the boat measured a couple of times with different trims to see if we could get some advantage on the waterline. We got it measured with up to 150 kilos of internal ballast to see if we could make some little shimmy shimmy there. And then we changed the headsail, the LL Max on the headsail. And when we did that, we got this massive drop in the ratings. It's like, aha, that's the thing that's making the big change. So when we had Amersport 1 and we had that big code 0, as soon as I took that off the rating, bumped straight, no problem at all. But IRC was measuring in that sail from 1999 when code 0 was the first cut, and they were first cut as flat cut, as you know, as jibs, essentially, just by the mid girth, as you correctly say. That sail that's behind me there is from about that time period. So there's a few different things going on there, but I appreciate the interaction, because God help you trying to write that on a phone. But let's talk sails, because that's how we all learn. I don't know anything about this tweener thing or anything. I haven't raced IRC in so long, I wouldn't know the front from the back. But thank you very much to Sea Atlantic Sail. I thought it might be a sailmaker. I just had this feeling. Okay, Andrew Moiser, thanks for this. He's looking at the folding rope one. God, I did that video so long ago. It was like the first one. They say that good is the enemy of great. I did one video. It got like 16,000 views on YouTube. And I like kind of threw in the towel there, like, that's it, I'm done. And it's been a massive uphill struggle ever since. But folding the rope is absolutely key. If you don't know that, have a look on the Marinettes. They've got the most views. It's like in my basement. I look like the child boy I used to be. But folding rope, holy mackerel, that stops it all getting knotted up. That's a really good one. So thank you to Adram Moiser, who's also a member on YouTube. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Okay, we'll do one more. We'll do one more. Yeah, okay, they're just little things hereafter, and then we'll have a look at the AI thing. He says, this is Mark Long 8608, who's looking at episode of the Mariner where I'm doing lashings to hold standing rigging. He says, you mentioned that even a slip of a few millimeters would throw the rigging tuning off, and it sounded like the point of that approach was adjustability, but I don't understand how you maintain the tension exactly where you want it while tying off the lashing, or adjust it afterwards. Is there another video that talks about that? Well, hey, now I know to make that video. So thank you very much, Mark Long 8608. I shall write in your comment section that we touched on this. If you get the correct number of turns on it, well, let me see, let's get this right. If you're doing it on something like a piece of rigging, you get the measurement when it's in position, and you know exactly how far away the two components need to be. So you have a millimeter measurement, which would be the equivalent of measuring your bottle screw and just, you know, getting the same measurement on the new one. So you know what it is when it's under tension, and you will know the length of rope that you made it from, essentially. So you'll already be in the right kind of wicket. You know how many wraps around it's got, so you'll be in the right kind of wicket. So you can lay, when everything's out of tension, you can lay in the loops and the lashing right there and then start to essentially play with it and work out, you know, how much you need to get the tension. You're going to be going on and off jack to make this happen, which is the kind of situation it's going to be working in, or just that you know the millimeter distance, and then you adjust it down to get to that. How do you hold it in the instant of, like, how do I tie this off? When you're tying off lashings, the number of wraps going around should be such that there's almost no pressure whatsoever on the turn that's about to go into the first hitch and secure the thing. But the first hitch should always be on one side, one half of the wraps going round and round and round. It's the same for when you're doing all sorts of things with, like, rope access and belaying people. And the way that you, if you have double ropes, the way you tie off first is to go around one of them. Because if you have, let's imagine a situation that's in front of you. If you have the bobbins, and you are wrapping around between the strands of rope as it goes up and down between the bobbins, if they've got tension on them, those upwards and downwards strands, that they really want to be apart, and the lashing that you're putting onto them, the hitch that you're putting onto them, is trying to bring them together. Now, of those forces, the whatever shape it may go to momentarily when you pull it tight, over time when it works, it's going to pull itself out and it's going to adjust the tension on everything. So the first hitch that you put on needs to be on just one set of the wraps on one side of the little thing that you've created. It's like a a letter, a zero, isn't it, with two little, a bobbin at the top and a bottom of the bobbin at the bottom. So you're just going to wrap off on one side of that and then go into the hitching, which for me is, I call it like a Polish hitch or something. I don't know, a Polish guy taught it to me. I don't know what it's called, but you do a hitch on one side, a hitch on the other side, a hitch on the other side, a hitch on the other side. That, instead of doing hitches round the whole thing, for the same reason that I just mentioned, that the two sides of this lashing are trying to pull themselves apart. And if you're doing something that's pulling them together, then you're setting up an internal tension in the lashing that just doesn't need to be there. It, I don't think it locks it off further or anything. It just creates the opportunity where it may move a bit. So just lash one side, lash the other side, hitch here, hitch there, and it ends up looking quite good as well. So that's been good enough for backstays on an open 60. I think it's probably good for anything. So I hope that's helpful. The other thing we're going to do here now as we go into 20 minutes quickly is I want to just keep using the AI thing. Yes, it's definitely tongue-in-cheek to have a questionnaire with, or not a questionnaire, sorry, a question time with AI, where you're asking for it like, hey, any hints on how to survive the apocalypse you're going to create. But I think also, if you might get age 46 or something, imagine what it was like for your parents when they were our age and then the internet started. They just kind of ignored it and kind of let it pass by. And then they ended up being 70, 80, and they still kind of didn't know how that worked. And I have a feeling that AI is going to be exactly like that, because once you start to play around a little bit with how it can help you in, and I say AI as a kind of overarching subject area, but ChatGPT, and I'm just using the free version, which is 3.5, which is like, you know, like the deck slug of chat GPT's options. We're just chatting to like like an able seaman here that's good for nothing, but holy mackerel, amazing things can happen. So the point is, I want to be able to talk to you for the remaining 10 minutes of this as we go into half an hour on the subject matter of, can a sailboat be used as a bug out vehicle? How I've been using ChatGPT recently to help me with my output here is I just go into the free version, which you do have to like put an email address in, but you know, we all know that what that deal is. And then it just comes out with a screen that looks a bit like an input box on a, you know, on like a messenger kind of thing on your phone, WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger, or however you normally send messages back and forwards to folks. We know what it looks like. It's a little box. You're going to type in it. So you just ask it any question that you can think of. And rather than getting a response from Google, which is, hey, there's a load of web pages that include those words, it's going to formulate an answer for you. So I used this recently to come up with the questions that I gave to the chief operating officer of a marine insurance company, because, and I put it to her in the email, I said, how on earth could I possibly ask insightful questions which are at the level of knowledge that you have after a, you know, a career in this industry? But out of respect from wanting to get good information from you, I have asked ChatGPT to formulate questions which I think politely express the kind of things I'm interested in, like how can the everyday person know if this is legitimate or not? And I put in the rejoinder that, hey, every single one of your customers is going to have access to this information themselves very soon. I think it's going to come very normal very quickly. I think what we're going to find soon is that information is going to get like cleaned out. We've been dealing with a lot of very processed information for a long time, and it's totally unclear what the level of like contamination is in this fuel tank. Like, it's not a fuel tank. I'll give you a better one. You know, what's the minimum amount of piss that you want in a fuel, in a water tank, right? It, like zero, but we all recognize that probably somehow through some crazy situation, a guy didn't wash his hands on the way back from the bathroom, there is some level of contamination of the water tank with piss. The thing with the information that we received on a day-to-day basis, we all know that there's a lot of bullshit going on and people are not being fair about the way they're expressing things, and it's to everyone's detriment. The question is, like, how much is there and what's the net effect of that? What's the compounded effect of everybody being on the take for 1%? Well, I think that things like AI might be the way forward. Obviously, there's loads of negativity to this. Don't get me wrong. I was one of the 40-odd thousand people that signed that petition saying they should slow down or, in fact, put an embargo on AI for at least 6 or 9 months and try and let everybody have time to catch up. It didn't happen. Here we are 6 or 9 months on, and suddenly I have one of these little like sidebar things, questions I've had here. It's called chatting with God. So you can get this thing to give you answers as though it were. So you could say, hey, I want you to give me an answer to this question as though you are Mahatma Gandhi, and it's going to do it, right? Or Jordan Peterson or the King of England or whatever. So play around with it and try. But for us, I can put in, what would be 10 good reasons to choose a sailboat as a bug out vehicle? Zoinks. Here we go. It says, choosing a sailboat as a bug out vehicle. Hang on, it's actually like literally writing it down the page. Just give it a second. Okay, it has finished now everything I'm going about to read you until the end of this podcast. Unbelievable. It says, choosing a sailboat as a bug out vehicle, especially in certain scenarios like coastal regions or islands, can offer numerous advantages. Here are 10 reasons why. Number one, versatility in terrain. A sailboat can navigate various terrains, including open water, coastal areas, and even rivers and lakes, offering flexibility in bug-out routes. Good point. Less reliance on fuel. Unlike motorized vehicles, which require constant refueling, sailboats rely on wind power, reducing the dependency on fuel and making them more sustainable in the long run. Yes, that's also a very good point. Okay, this is why it's going to take over, because it's too damn good. Okay, low operating costs. Wow, clearly doesn't know anything about boats. Once purchased, the ongoing costs of maintaining a sailboat are generally lower than it should be, lower compared to traditional motorized vehicles. Yep, I guess, as long as you don't worry about the sails, that's how most sailors seem to be organizing it, especially in terms of fuel and maintenance. Okay, yeah, so once you've got the boat, and it's part of your life anyway, you're not really adding much in, are you? Okay, cool. Self-sustainability. With the right equipment and knowledge, a sailboat can be self-sufficient for extended periods, carrying water desalination systems, solar panels for electricity, and even onboard gardens for fresh produce. That one like basil in the corner, which is definitely not alive anymore. Stealth and avoidance. Sailboats can offer a degree of stealth and avoidance, especially, you know, that Whitbread 60 I had black sails. That'd be very good. Sailboats can offer a degree of stealth and avoidance. Okay, I'm down. I'm back in it now. Especially in scenarios where you might want to evade detection or bypass congested areas, as they can navigate in relatively shallow waters and avoid roadblocks. Well, okay. Again, not the boats I have, but you're right. Like if you had something, that's interesting. I remember being on the canals in the US and people had like little catamarans and they had the masts in a tabernacle and they could get it down pretty quickly. But the thing with the catamarans is that there was like, the rule is no wake, but there's hardly any wake from a catamaran. So you could go a lot faster and still be making no wake. It was very noticeable with the monohulls. But yeah, you could move around very, very smoothly and subtly if you were making no wake and just had a little hidden away little Yanmars in the back of some catamaran or something. That's a great idea. Okay, isn't this wonderful? Like it made this in like a couple of seconds. Now we've got this to talk about. I think these are areas that we can get into a bit more. I'm just going to touch on it again today and sort of get your feedback. But I think this is a very interesting area. Less vulnerability to traffic jams and blockades. During a bug out situation, roads can become congested or blocked entirely. A sailboat bypasses this vulnerability, allowing for smoother travel. I was thinking about this the other day. It's literally like in the truck, we could be at one of our boats in 30 minutes. But if there wasn't, I was thinking, because I'm a guy, right? So whenever anybody asks a stupid question like, what are you actually thinking about now? The answer is nothing to do with what's going on around me. So during some period of time in the last week in which I was definitely not being tasked with working out this problem, I worked out that you could take a canoe, which we have, put it on the river right next to our property, which is like a couple of hundred meters away. And then it's 30 kilometers down the river, but it's a river, so it's kind of easy to navigate. And there are no rapids straight down to like the ocean. So now it's nowhere near where the where the boat is, but we can move the mooring, I guess. It could be kind of a big deal. But, you know, it's interesting to think these things through, isn't it? Play the what if game. So I'm bored of playing what if at sea. So now I have fun playing what if the zombies turn up? What does it say here? Escape from coastal threats. In regions prone to natural disasters like hurricanes or tsunamis, a sailboat provides a means of escape, allowing you to quickly move away from the coastline to safer waters. I remember when it was like definitely a massive bit of theatre that there was any kind of an issue around 2012. The Mayan calendar supposedly were like coming to an end, where all it was actually doing was starting again. It was like getting freaked out that it was going to be the end of time on December the 31st. Like, hey, we survived. It's January 1st. But at that time, I remember the people around me at times, like, if anything starts to happen here, this is like what the plan is. And the at sea plan was exactly that. It's like, get a boat and go out into the middle of the ocean. When they had those tsunamis in Asia, which killed so many people offshore, people had just a oversized wave go underneath them. So it is a legitimate opportunity. And the other thing is, you just head for the Azores. That's my plan. That's what I've kind of worked out from where I am here on the east coast of the US. Like, go to the Azores. Like, they have their entire national grid is everything is there that they need, right? They're not connected to anybody else. They already know how to do this task. So let's go there is my idea. Or Iceland would be another one like that, right? They know how to do this. Like, okay, it's gonna be hard. They're not gonna get imports and that, but like, we can make power and we can keep the lights on and we can keep like sane. If you're in parts of Europe or America and things start to go wrong in one area, that's gonna spread. Things do spread, hey, even if you try and lock down, I've heard. Ability to carry supplies. Sailboats have ample storage space, allowing you to carry a significant amount of supplies, including food, water, medical supplies, and other essentials crucial during a bug out scenario. I think that's absolutely correct. Interestingly, you know, I think of a couple of boats I've seen in marinas, which are like, clearly people are thinking about bug out boats. I saw a camo painted boat once. I've seen black painted boats, which are like painted with a roller kind of black painted boats. But interestingly, with boats in marinas, like, I don't know, unless people are like going from boat to boat, ransacking the boats, you know, a white, like, Beneteau 40-something in a marina, no one is going to know that you're in there. You'd be lost just because there's so many, well, across the world, obviously millions and millions of these things. But in any one location, like, if you're on a boat somewhere in Fort Lauderdale, you may as well be on Mars. There's no AI or zombie or anything's going to find you. Just keep chilling out, watching the TV. But yeah, it's the stealth thing. Interestingly, yeah, black sails, nighttime, okay. But also just getting lost in amongst all the other boats and things, being out at anchor. Yeah, it could be quite an interesting area. That's right. Connection with nature and reduced stress. Well, that's a bit of a curveball. Okay, come on, AI. Being on the water and away from the chaos of land can reduce stress levels. Sailing offers a unique connection with nature, which can be beneficial for mental well-being during times of crisis. I think it's like urging us onto the water. I think that's what's going on here. Hey, who's playing who here? Who's holding the strings? I was asking you stuff. It's telling us to bugger off and like, hey, I won't come after you if you're on the water. Anyway, however, it says it's important to note that choosing a sailboat as a bug out vehicle requires specific skills, which we have, haha, knowledge, which we have, and preparation, which we'd like to do, but kind of busy today. But as sailors normally do, we'll get it worked out somehow. So it's not as simple, it says, as hopping on and sailing away, but it could be. Proper training, equipment, and planning are essential. We should start now to ensure safety and success in using a sailboat for bug out purposes. What I think is that whether we like it or not, we already have bought the major investment piece to become a boat prepper. So we may as well just wear that badge of pride and see what it's all about. You know, if it's about sustainability of stuff on board, that absolutely relates to crossing any kind of ocean. If it relates to navigation when there's no GPS or something, like, we can cover that. So yeah, fun. We'll keep doing this. But it's fun using ChatGPT. If you haven't, I think it's worth using. I've got all sorts of extra conversations I've had with it, even down to I needed an adapter to attempt to convert between a North American pipe system and a European faucet, which I had, which over there, of course, would be called a tap. But how on earth do you find that? You could go online and find it out, like, through the machinations of the internet, how we all know that works. But what I did is came to ChatGPT and said, I have got this tap and I am in this location and I need this thing. And it just told me, oh, buddy, you need it, and gave me the exact, like, if it could have connected me to Amazon, I would have pressed click, you know? So yeah, you can use it in all kinds of ways. So there we go. That's all I've got for you. That's the end of this dog watch. It's meant to be just a load of kind of gibbering, because I realize that sometimes that's just all you need, right? We don't have to be like concentrating all the time. I would say I was right about the bell rope, and I'm pretty sure I was right about the code zero. So that's 2 out of 3, and have a bit of fun doing it. So wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you are safe and sound. I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.